This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Usually in movies, when we see a character age, it's with the help of makeup and prosthetics, or using different actors as the character ages. But in the new film Boyhood, none of that is necessary. The film takes place over the course of 12 years, and it was shot over the course of 12 years. So we watch the actors getting older for real, which gives their characters a sense of authenticity. Boyhood was written and directed by my guest Richard Linklater, who also made the films Slacker, Dazed and Confused, The Before Sunrise Trilogy, School of Rock, and Bernie. Boyhood begins when the main character, Mason, is six, and his sister is a couple of years older. They're living in a small town in Texas with their mother, who's divorced from their father. Over the next 12 years, we watch the children grow up, and their parents stumble their way through the next stage of adulthood. The parents are played by Ethan Hawke, who co-starred in Linklater's Before Sunrise Trilogy, and Patricia Arquette. The boy is played by Ellar Coltrane. His sister is played by Linklater's daughter, Lorelai. Let's start with a scene from about a quarter of the way through the film. The mother has remarried and found out too late that her husband drinks and has an authoritarian streak. He's forced her shaggy-haired son to get a buzz cut. The boy is really embarrassed by his haircut. Soon after this happens, he's alone in the car with his mother and lets her know how angry he is.
I mean, he didn't even ask. He just cut it. I mean, it's my hair.
Well, no wonder you were angry. I'd be angry, too.
You're a Martian now.
Honey, you know what? I'm going to talk to him about it later, okay?
I tried to call you, but you didn't answer your phone.
I'm so sorry. I've been so busy with school. Hey, for what it's worth, it's hair, and it will grow back. Now I can see your pretty eyes and your foxy face.
Why'd you even marry him? Such a jerk.
Well, Bill has his good qualities. You know, nobody's perfect. And now we have a family.
We already had a family.
Richard Linklater, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, throughout my life, I've always wondered, like, gee, what's that baby going to look like as a child? And what's that child going to look like as a teenager? And what's that teenager going to look like as an adult? And what's that adult going to look like as an elderly person? When I was in, like, grade school, I used to think, like, what's the kid sitting next to me going to look like an adult? Because I couldn't fathom kids my age looking like adults. It seemed just unimaginable to me that we'd all grow into what adults look like. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that's part of what you were thinking about in shooting this film over 12 years?
Well, I don't know if that was the main motivation, but it was certainly kind of part of the idea, was to see people transform in one sitting of a movie, to see them transform into that young adult in this case, or see the adults get older. I mean, that is a fascinating journey we all make. I run into friends that I grew up with, and I look in their faces and like, oh my God, we're middle-aged people now, and I still see the little kid they were. And it's you know, it's fascinating. You see a picture of yourself when you were little, and God, are you even still that person? Yes, there's a connection there, but I was in the unique once-in-a-lifetime position, really. It felt like when I was choosing the young actor, Ellar Coltrane, I was staring in the face of a six-year-old thinking, not just curious, what are you going to be like? What are you going to look like when you're, you know, 18, but it was kind of professionally important to me. You know, I was banking the whole movie on this kid and thinking, what kind of person are you going to grow up to be?
Now, you cast your daughter as the older sister in the movie, and she's like, mm-hmm. what, a couple of years older than
yeah.
her brother?
She was 9 and Ellar was 7 when we started, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So tell me why you cast your daughter. I was thinking part of the reason, I'm guessing here, that part of the reason was if you were willing to put your daughter through it, then you'd feel more comfortable putting Ellar Coltrane through it. And also his parents would feel more comfortable thinking like, well, his own daughter's doing it, so he's going to treat my son okay.
Uh-oh. They don't know who they're dealing with. No. You know, I never really thought of that. I guess that might have impressed them that, oh, yeah, I'm putting my family on the line for this. So, but it was really, I almost felt like I didn't cast Lorelai. She, once it was apparent that the older sister was in her age range, you know, the kind of starts off kind of the annoying older sister. she sort of insisted on the part. I never really thought about casting it traditionally. She sort of took the part like, Daddy, well, I'm playing that part. You know, she had grown up on movie sets. She had been in other movies, little parts. And it was just very natural for her. She was very extroverted at that point in her life. And, you know, the sassy kid you see at the beginning of the movie, that was her.
So you describe the character that your daughter, Lorelai Linkletter, plays in the movie as like the annoying older sister.
Starts off that way.
So here's a starting off as the annoying older sister moment.
Oh yeah.
She's singing the Britney Spears hit "Oops, I Did It Again," and her younger brother is just feeling like tormented by being forced to watch her sing this, and she's like dancing around the room and everything. So mm-hmm. Let me just play that moment, and you'll hear him just kind of feeling tormented, and then she starts kind of, you know, tormenting him, and then the mother walks in and
she fakes crying.
And she fakes that he hit her when really she's the one who's been picking on him. So here's the scene. And this is Richard Linkletter's daughter, Lorelai Linkletter as the older sister and L.R. Coltrane as the brother.
Oops, I did it again. I played with your heart, got lost in the game. Oh, baby, baby, whoops, you think I'm love? I'll set the bar.
Stop!
Not that innocent.
Quit
it! The problem is this. I'm dreaming away, wishing the hills really exist. I cry watching the days. You see, I'm a fool in so many ways. But to lose all of my sins.
What the hell is going on in here? Do you guys know what time it is? Mason, do not throw things at your sister.
She's faking. She hit me first.
Listen, both of you. I'm going back to bed. I don't want to hear another peep out of here for an hour. Go to sleep.
Faker!
That was Patricia Arquette as the mother. My guest Richard Linkletter wrote and directed the movie, which is called Boyhood. So I think that's great, and I was wondering if your daughter Lorelai at the time was singing "Oops, I Did It Again" around the house, and I was wondering also what you thought of it when she was singing around the house, because you know Britney Spears are so kind of like sexualized as a young teen, and parents were like, "Oh my gosh, do I really want my daughter being that sexualized that young?"
No, my daughter lives in another, at that age, lived in another century. She was listening to harpsichord. She's kind of a medievalist. So she wasn't really that familiar with Britney Spears. I mean, she knew the name, and I think she had heard the song. She had to kind of learn that for the movie. But she was singing and dancing to her namesake, Marilyn Monroe's character in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, singing Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. That she would sing and dance to at a drop of a hat. She was a big Marilyn Monroe fan at that time. So I even filmed as a backup in case I never got the rights to the Britney Spears song. I had her doing a take of From Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. So that's really more who she was.
So I want to jump ahead in time a few years in the movie. And this is a scene when your daughter, Lorelai Linkletter, is in high school. We just heard her when she was about 9. Now she's in this scene, she's in high school, and her younger brother's in middle school. Mm-hmm. And so in this scene, she's with one of her girlfriends, talking at home in her bedroom, and her mother walks in and is really angry that she neglected to do what she promised to do, which is pick up her younger brother from middle school. Mm-hmm. So here's the scene.
Samantha! Why the hell didn't you pick up your brother like you said you would?
I know what you're going to say. She was running late, and we couldn't turn around.
No excuses. The bottom line is you didn't do what you said you were going to do. You stranded your brother.
It's embarrassing to ask my friend to turn around and go get some kid at the middle school.
What do you mean some kid? He's your brother. And you know what? We've helped Janie out before. I mean, she lives right around the corner. It's no big deal.
Sorry.
You know what, Samantha? You need to start thinking long and hard about who you want to be. Do you want to be a cooperative person who's compassionate and helps people out, or do you want to be a self-centered narcissist?
You know what? You're right. I am this horrible person, but honestly, he's not a baby anymore. You don't have to treat him like one. He's in eighth grade, and he can find his way home if he wants to.
You know what? When Gabby leaves, you and me are going to have a chat.
That's Lorelai Linkletter and Patricia Arquette in a scene from Richard Linkletter's new movie, Boyhood. And I love just hearing back to back the clip where your daughter is like 9 and singing Oops, I Did Again, and then hearing her in high school. It's much more interesting when you can see it, too. So Boyhood is not a thriller, but I found myself being nervous during a lot of the movie because I was always worrying that, oh, the kids will hurt themselves or get into trouble or something's going to go wrong. And it made me think, I'm not a parent, but it made me think about how parents probably live their lives that way, because there's always so much to worry about when your children are growing up.
Oh, it's the worst thing that gets imposed on you as a parent. Like, your carefree days are over because just that part of your, what's that part of the brain that is on the lookout for all danger?
I mean, it's
that
called goes my on, brain.
Yeah, just your entire brain.
Yeah.
Well, that goes on red alert. That gets, that knob goes to 11 and you're spending your whole time like, okay, how are you going to, your job is to protect your kids. And to such a degree. So, but you see it, we're conditioned. Audiences are conditioned, you know. In the film, there's a scene where the boys are like throwing these saw blades at a sheetrock. And I can feel it in the audience. And it was the last thing that crossed my mind. It never crossed my mind in the shooting of that there would be blood or violence or any mistakes. It was just these guys kind of screwing around. But I felt it in the audience, like, ooh, okay, this is where the kid falls back on the blade and, you know, we have to cuts off a finger or something. But it just... that usually doesn't happen in life. And this thing was so much about kind of, you know, most you get through life and there aren't these huge traumatic, there's a lot of little things. And there's another scene where his dad has warned him, don't drive in text. And he is on a little road trip driving with his girlfriend. She hands him the phone. He looks at a picture while he's driving. Okay, here's where the car goes off the highway. But you see how much we're conditioned in our, you know, plot-based storytelling to have the, to set these things up and pay them off. And you realize just how fake that is to life. Most of us do survive childhood. Most of the bad things don't happen. You know, we spend all our lives in fear for these things that never happen. And when things do happen, it's unexpected. It's not the way you thought it would. And you realize there's nothing, not much you could have done to prevent it. But yet you have to be concerned as a parent. So it's a tough trick to maintain.
But you're so right that we're conditioned in movies to expect, like, oh, this is where the saw amputates his arm, or yeah, this is where the car drives off the road, or yeah.
It just doesn't happen. But that doesn't mean the film isn't.
But the thing is, sometimes it does happen. Sometimes it does happen.
Sometimes it does. You know, who gets through childhood without some stitches or a broke? You know, you're going to wear a cast for it at some point. You know, something's going to happen. But I just, that itself wasn't that dramatic to me. I was going for the little drama of life where maybe it doesn't feel that dramatic to the parent. Like, oh, we're moving. You know, you're the new kid in school. So what? You know, but for the kid, that's highly dramatic. That's traumatic, you know. So I was trying to, from the kid's perspective, get just how dramatic, you know, life can feel, even though it maybe to another perspective, it doesn't feel that way or look that way, but it is. It's pretty dramatic. Just getting through life is pretty dramatic.
The character of the father in your movie, the Ethan Hawke character, he kind of disappears for a while. He's in Alaska, and then he comes back and wants to become a presence in his children's lives again. But, you know, he's the kind of father who's like a lot of fun to be around and really talkative, and he takes them bowling and camping and this and that. But he doesn't have the responsibility that the mother has. So on the one hand, he's very likable. On the other hand, you know, she's got to do all the work. And he reminded me, he could have so easily have been a character, I think, in Slacker or Dazed and Confused. somebody who grows up but is still somehow committed to the life they lived as a teenager and doesn't quite know how to, like, what he wants as an adult or how to be an adult. And he wants to have a life in music, but he isn't really pursuing it. Did you think of him that way,
he follows this wonderful, I think he does mature. You see a guy kind of slowly giving up maybe his dreams of being a songwriter, or clearly something happened between them that separated him from his family for a while there and his kids. But before the movie starts, or between the first and second year, when he shows up in the movie, he's clearly made a decision off screen to be a dad to those kids. You know, he's come back. He wants to be around them geographically and get his act together. And you see him consciously trying to be a good dad. He does love them, and he's trying very hard. But he's kind of, you know, like I said earlier, he's kind of bumbling through parenthood. He's figuring it out, but kind of endearingly self-consciously. And I just think he's trying, which as a parent, that's so much of the game, you know, just to try. We're all going to get it wrong anyway, but you have to at least try.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Linklater, and his new movie is called Boyhood, and his other films include Dazed and Confused and Slacker and Bernie. I want to ask you about Bernie, since the story of that movie has become a story for you in real life off the screen. Bernie is based on the real story of a mortician who came to a small Texas town to practice, and apparently everybody in town just loved him because he took such good care of the bereaved and did such caring funeral services. He became very close to an older woman who in the movie is played by Shirley MacLaine, and the character of Bernie is played by Jack Black. So he becomes very attached to this very wealthy older woman who kind of shows him this new life of, like, fine food and travel around the world and beautiful clothes and stuff. But she becomes so domineering and so much, like, treating him as if he's her servant. He kind of, like, snaps and actually shoots her to death and hides her for several months in the freezer until her body's discovered. He stood trial. He was found guilty, sentenced to life. But recently, tell us what happened.
Well, God, it's been such an interesting, crazy journey. You know, I made that movie, which is...
You know what? Before you tell us what happened, I'm going to play a scene where Bernie's...
Okay, sure.
So this is the scene in which he's being interrogated by a police officer, and it's in this scene that he actually confesses to the murder. The police officer starts first.
How long you been thinking about killing her, Bernie?
I never thought of me killing Mrs. Nugent. I guess I fantasized about her death, but I was never the one responsible for it. Didn't she always die accidentally, like in a car accident or falling down the escalator at the mall in Longview? I was always the one weeping by her open casket, comforting others, being comforted myself.
Why'd you want her dead, Bernie?
She had become so mean and possessive of me, I couldn't face being around her any longer, and then it just happened. I don't know. I shot her. I shot poor Mrs. Nugent 4 times with the armadillo gun.
Then what?
Well, then the Lord called her home. I know I'd done wrong and I must atone for my sins.
Jack Black playing Bernie Tita in a film directed and co-written by my guest Richard Linklater. Great scene, great performance from Jack Black.
Jack is incredible.
Yeah, and that's based on real life, and he was serving a life sentence. And that was changed. He's out now and living in your garage apartment. Why was the case reopened?
Yes.
Was it your movie?
Well, the movie was kind of the linchpin to that. It's funny. It's not a documentary. You know, it's just this kind of dark comedy. And it was a case I followed. I went to the trial back in '99, and I felt there was a movie there. I was so fascinated with that relationship and the whole culture surrounding it. And ultimately, it's a very interesting legal case that's portrayed in the movie. They move the trial because he's too well-liked. He gets from going from almost maybe getting off for the killing, he is punished, in my mind and many others, like way too much. He gets a life sentence for what was clearly kind of a, I don't know, to me and many others, it felt like a... definitely a murder with circumstances, kind of an abusive relationship. There was a lot going on, you know, between them that led to the tragedy. We had gotten to know Bernie. We went and visited him in prison, and it sort of confirmed what I felt all along, that he wasn't this psychopath. He actually was the nicest guy in the world who had been driven to do this act, and it kind of begged the question if if the nicest guy could do that, what about the rest of us? Are we all capable of that? You know, given the right circumstances, the right abusive relationship, maybe we are. And that was very intriguing to me. But the film doesn't really advocate. It just lays out, you know, what actually happened. A lot of that's based on the real transcript and what I saw at the trial, and no one really doubts it. But a lawyer saw the movie. I started talking to her, Jody Cole, there in Austin, and she had a real sensitivity toward abuse, I think.
But the lawyer you're talking about did some investigation and found evidence that convinced her that he had been sexually abused as a child, and that led to a dissociative experience, is I think the language?
Well, it was one more piece of a puzzle, a psychological puzzle, that you always wonder what would drive someone. You know, when the abused victim finally lashes back and kills the abuser, the question is, well, why didn't you just leave? They're dead and you're going to prison. You know, why didn't you just leave? It makes so much sense to the rest of us. But Jack Black asked Bernie that question. And he answered it. He was like, oh, I couldn't do that. I mean, I was her only friend, you know. I mean, I was all she had. As much as she was torturing him to death, he loved her enough and felt for her, because he was this compassionate person, was and is. And that what would lead to that is, Jody surmised when she found a few books about surviving sexual abuse, and that when Bernie was young, there was an uncle in his life, he and a cousin, and
she found books in his,
yeah, just kind of going through the list of his
surviving sexual abuse.
And Bernie had never brought it up, you know, because I think it's something you just don't talk about. But it all kind of contributed to a bigger picture of, okay, well, he survived abuse himself, and that doesn't give you license to kill, but it's a lot of people do survive a lot of trauma and don't do that, but it gives further explanation, I think. It provides a context when presented with that, and given that Bernie had served 17 years, that all led to a judge in our legal system kind of seeing it in a different way and thinking, well, he had served time. And there was a group of us who, if Bernie were to get out, or that be a possibility, you know, I said, sure, he can live in my garage apartment while he gets on
his feet.
Yeah,
well, that's what you offered. You know? You offered to have him live in your garage apartment, and that was one of the conditions of his release. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, how has that changed your life to have the subject of your film, who is a confessed murderer under extenuating circumstances, now being your tenant and neighbor?
All that other stuff doesn't matter. I'm just happy for Bernie that he's a citizen in the world, that he has a job, that he's reconnected with
friends.
What's
his job?
He's a paralegal. He got training. He's a very intelligent man. And so I'm happy to help in any way. And it's kind of an open-ended arrangement. He can stay as long as he needs to.
Richard Linklater wrote and directed the new film Boyhood. You'll find a longer version of our conversation on Fresh Air's website at freshair.npr.org. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of the new album Heal from musician Timothy Showalter, who's been recording under the name Strand of Oaks since 2006. In the studio, he plays nearly all the instruments himself. Showalter has cited performers ranging from Jeff Buckley to Richard Pryor as influences. I was born in the middle.
If you're going to be downbeat, glum, or morose, it's best to do it the way Timothy Showalter does it, which is with an energy and purpose that doesn't contradict the melancholy, but rather frames it as various stories, studies in seriousness. He records under the name Strand of Oaks. He writes and performs nearly all of the music on this new album himself, and it's titled Heal, as in healing a wound, something Strand of Oaks frequently seems in need of.
And all the you hold them up for me, and all the little things
I wait for love, Showalter sings on that song, and he does a lot of that sort of waiting over the course of this album. It's a collection of songs about missed connections, missed opportunities, friends and lovers who are missed by a narrator who's more than willing to take the blame for all of it. Which could be unbearable spread over 10 songs, but isn't at all. Because the music here is frequently big, billowy stuff, with melodies that ripple with muscle, powering its way past self-pity and regret. The singer invites you to learn some of the sources of this work in the superb autobiographical song Goshen 97. Goshen is Goshen, Indiana, where, if you take him at his word, the young Timothy Showalter lived in his family basement during the 1990s. He was listening to bands like Smashing Pumpkins and starting to piece together sounds and words that would describe his own mood, which can be summed up by that chorus, "I was lonely, I was having fun." Starting in 2006, he began putting out recordings as Strand of Oaks, sounding more quiet, more like a folk singer than not. As the years have gone by, Strand of Oaks' music has become bigger and brawnier. But there are also moments when the volume drops and the melody becomes beautiful in its yearning. Sometimes I move like shadow. Sometimes I move like. Over and over, the songs here circle back to the theme of healing, of having your heart broken or your dreams dashed, or having someone who meant a lot to you vanish from your life. But you go on, you do what you have to do to get past as much of the pain as possible. That could be just another singer-songwriter trying to put out a positive message, but with Strand of Oaks, it becomes a much more nuanced drama. With each song here, you want to hear how it all began and hear how it all ends.
Rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed Heal, the new album from Strand of Oaks. Coming up, we talk about cybercrime with journalist Brian Krebs. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Remember the data breach at Target late last year that resulted in hackers stealing information from about 40 million credit cards? That news was broken by my guest Brian Krebs, who helped uncover the story. Just a few days later, he broke the story of a credit card breach at Neiman Marcus. Krebs writes about cybercrime and computer security for his blog, Krebs on Security, which he started in 2009. Before that, he spent 14 years working as a reporter at the Washington Post, where he covered tech policy, privacy, and computer security, and wrote the blog The Security Fix. His book Spam Nation, about organized cybercrime, is scheduled for publication in November. In order to do his work, Krebs has learned computer code, the Russian language, and how to get onto black market websites and cybercrime networks. Cybercriminals who don't appreciate his work have found creative and frightening ways to harass him. Brian Krebs, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with what's probably the most famous story that you broke, which was the breach at Target. I had assumed, I guess I wasn't reading this carefully enough, I had assumed Target had reported the breach. That's not the way it worked. You discovered it. So let's start with, how did you find out?
Right. Well, so let's be clear. The Secret Service, according to Target, the Secret Service alerted Target, I think, on December 12th. I didn't get wind of this until, and so for whatever reason, you know, Target was trying to figure out what was going on, figure out how bad it was, how they were going to talk about this at a very sensitive time. They didn't immediately disclose this, and it came to my attention that something wasn't right with Target, I think on December 16th, when I started hearing from different sources in the financial community who were saying, you know, Brian, we are just seeing a tremendous number of our cards, probably an unprecedented number of our cards that we've issued to customers showing up for sale on this one underground store. And I think it's important to kind of point something out here. Most people, when I talk to them about underground stores, you kind of get this blank stare, right? Like, what exactly are you talking about? There are literally dozens, if not hundreds, of these shops in the underground, and they're not hard to find. If you know the URL, you know the IP address, you can load these, you can create an account. If you want to fund it with bitcoins or whatever, you can go ahead and buy whatever they have for sale. But this shop in particular was moving millions of stolen cards onto the market all at once. And I worked with three different financial institutions. One was a very large financial institution, and they acquired a whole bunch of their cards back from this store. And sure enough, they had all been used between Thanksgiving and mid-December. If you go back and you look at each one of these cards and you see that they were all used at the same place within the same time frame, that's a pretty good indicator. It's called a common point of purchase. And it's a pretty good indicator that that's the source of the breach.
Get the cards, they check the numbers and to see what were these cards used to purchase, and they found that all of these cards that they bought had made purchases at Target, therefore maybe it was connected to that.
At some point, yeah, and exactly. And at some point you get beyond maybe to near certainty, uh-huh. Right? I mean, it's just a math problem, right? I mean, you know, if these banks acquire 10 cards each and there's three different banks and they all were used at Target between at the same 3-week time frame, that's a pretty good indicator. And at that point, I felt good enough to run a story, and I reached out to the company and said, looks like, you know, you're having a bad day or bad week or bad month, or bad year or something like that. And they basically said, talk to the hand. So I read my story. They said they had a breach. They came out the next day, said, yeah, we had this little incident, impacted like 40 million cards and, you know, 70 million people's personal information.
Because you have uncovered so much cybercrime, there are some cyber criminals who would really like to seek their revenge against you. And some of them have come up with some pretty unusual ways of doing it, including, this is a really interesting one, the guy who sent heroin to you, notifying the police that he was sending heroin to you, expecting them to come and bust you when the heroin arrived. So who was behind this?
Right. So at the time, I really didn't know much about who was behind this. But I did notice that there was an individual. This was probably spring of 2013. An individual on Twitter started sending me really nasty and malicious tweets. And some of his Russian-speaking buddies also started sending the same things. And he changed his Twitter profile to be, a picture of an action figure holding up my severed head. And then it was a picture of my face with Gestapo uniform and male genitalia next to it or whatever. So I was like, okay, what is going on? And this guy starts really harassing me. And I figured out that the guy who was harassing me actually was an administrator of a very exclusive cybercrime forum that caters to Russian and Ukrainian criminals who essentially do all kinds of card fraud and identity theft. And I worked with a source of mine who was able to essentially get me access to his forum, which was no small feat. But it was none too soon because it became very clear that he was in the middle of hatching a plan to send heroin to my house. So his goal was he took up a collection of other crooks on the forum. And I think they collected like 2 bitcoins, which at the time was, about $1,000. And they went on the Silk Road, which is the place where you can buy heroin on the internet, essentially, or guns or whatever you want.
It's like a black market site.
Yeah, it's a black market, the black market bazaar. So their plan was to send the drugs to my home and then, call the police when it arrived and say, oh, the drugs are well hidden, make sure you search his house really well. And spoof a call from my neighbors, basically saying, Kreb's got people coming in and out of the house at all hours. He's been like lazing around the porch. We're really not sure. I think he's on drugs, and now he's buying drugs. So thankfully, I was able to sort of track this scheme as it was unfolding. They even put the tracking number for the shipment in the forum posting, which so I could track the drugs as they were headed to my house. I called the police and said, look, I'm not a druggie, and here's how you know. I'll never forget the cop came out to take a report, and I'm showing him all these screenshots and saying, I believe, just trust me, okay, I know it's in Russian, but this is what they're saying, and you could see the pictures of the heroin, the guy they're buying him from, and that guy's just shaking his head the whole time, and he takes the report and he's like, all right, give me a call when the drugs come and we'll pick them up. I said, okay. He goes, I'll never forget. He goes, I said, all right, well, thanks for coming, be safe. And I hear him mutter as he walk out the door. He's like, yeah, I'm not the one getting, Russian sending drugs to my house. But anyway, they did show up and I called the cops. They came and picked him up and that was that. And then I got really curious, as you can imagine, about, all right, who was this jokester that sent drugs to my house? And I wanted to know who he was in real life. So it really wasn't super difficult to figure that out. And I figured out he was a Ukrainian fraudster who was actually living in Italy with his wife and young boy. And he was running a credit card fabrication factory in Naples. And I shared this information with some friends who shared it with some other friends, I think. And a few weeks ago, got a heads up that that basically this guy is, who went by the name The Fly, that he'd been arrested. So that was kind of a cathartic moment for me.
So what else have hackers done to you out of revenge for things you've revealed about them?
I can't always say it's revenge. It's sort of like the heroin case. Some of this just, maybe it's become sort of a meme or trend for people just to pick on Brian Krebs. But in March of last year, the heavily armed police force showed up at my home apropos of nothing. Somebody had called in, they call it swatting. Somebody had called in a fake hostage situation at my home, they said that Russians had broken into my home and shot my wife and that I was hiding in the closet. Send, guns and forces to get these guys out of my house. That was a pretty troubling experience.
They actually showed up?
They showed up. And in fact, I had called 6 months in advance the non-emergency number for the local police department and said that this actually might happen. Some of the guys that I write about tend to do this for fun to each other. And the guy that took the report
he'd never heard of swatting. He didn't really even know what it was. And I said, yeah, look, here's what happens. Here's my cell phone. Give me a call. If you get somebody who says there's a hostage situation going on in my house, just give me a call before you roll truck with the troops to my house. And to their credit, they actually did call. My phone was upstairs. I was downstairs vacuuming because I was getting ready to have company over. I just happened to open the door, and there's this heavily armed police force pointing shotguns and AR-15s and pistols at my face. And it was if that never happens again, it'll be too soon.
So even though you called, they still sent out the SWAT team?
Yeah, they did. They had me put my hands up, walk, and it was about 30 degrees. I'm in my gym shorts and a t-shirt and socks, and they had me walk down my front stoop backwards, and then they handcuffed me and put me in the squad car. And this is all happening at about 5:45 to 6 in the evening on a weekday. So all the people trying to come home from work are, the police have barricaded the entrance to our neighborhood. You know, people are staring out their windows. So it was quite a scene.
Awkward.
Yeah.
Oh, they're taking them away.
Yeah. The other things that happen constantly.
Did you contact this guy who was responsible for the swatting incident?
I did. I spoke with him at length. He is a young man.
Spoke with him via the internet?
Yes, via instant message. He's a young man with a very colorful past, and basically really talented hacker who's broken into some very, very sensitive places and caused a lot of problems for people. And he's currently dealing with a whole bunch of different criminal charges, but he's a minor. He's under 18. So the federal system really doesn't know what to do with minors, at least when it comes to cybercrime charges. And I think a lot of these guys know it, so they consider it pretty harmless. And at the end of the day, they consider that if they get in trouble, they'll be out of trouble within a year or two. So,
there's so many scams to watch out for in terms of cybercrime. Give us some basic tips of things that we should do, whether we're shopping at a store or online or just opening up our email.
Yeah. So for one thing, I have a three rules sort of mantra, and the first one is, if you didn't go looking for it, don't install it. Okay, so this is, you go to a site and it says, hey, in order to use, to view this content, you need to install this. Well, probably not the best idea because you don't really know what they're giving you to install. So if you think you need to install something, go to the vendor of that software, get it from them, and do it that way. If you installed something, update it, right? A lot of people's computers no longer belong to them because it gets taken over by malicious software that basically installs itself because people don't update the stuff that's plugged into their browser, right? So it might be Flash or Java or Adobe Reader or whatever, and they go to a site that is hacked, and all of a sudden their computer doesn't belong to them anymore, and all their passwords and everything on it's, stolen. So if you installed it, update it. And then the third one is, if you don't need it anymore, get rid of it. It's one less program to worry about, one less program to update, etc. So that covers a lot of the cybercrime that might hit you as a consumer using the computer. The other thing is be really careful with email. I mean, a majority of this stuff comes through spam, via malicious links in emails or attachments. Be extremely wary of anything sent to you in email.
Is there a way to know if your computer's been compromised and it's being used as part of a botnet?
It's really, really important that you keep up to date with this stuff, the software updates, and be wary about what people are sending you in email, because it's a lot easier to keep your system from getting infected than it is to figure it out once it's infected and figure out how to fix it after damage is done. And increasingly, and I say this is a really important point, because it used to be, you had to go to some help forum and, get some volunteer to help you figure out how to remove the software. These days, if your system gets compromised, there's an excellent chance that all of your data, so all of your pictures, your important files, anything that you value on your system is going to be held for ransom.
Held for ransom? What do you mean?
They call it ransomware. And so the first thing this malware does is it encrypts all of your data with very, very difficult to crack encryption. Encryption that would be hard for, say, the NSA to even break. And they say, hey, look, then you get a pop-up. Once it's done with this process, it lets you know your system's infected. It says, hey, you know, your friendly neighborhood cyber criminal here, sorry to bother you, but we've encrypted all your files. You have 72 hours to pay up or we'll delete your files forever. And it's really sad when you talk to people who've been hit by this because, unfortunately, there's not a lot you can tell them. I mean, they can pay the ransom or they can kiss their files goodbye. Because increasingly, you don't get a second chance. You know, when your computer gets compromised, as I said, it's not your computer anymore, and it isn't your data anymore. Somebody else owns it.
Is this why you wrote in your blog that 2014 may be the year extortion went mainstream?
Yeah, partly. This ridiculous number of these cyber attacks now involve some kind of ransomware component. And the other part of it is that recently we started seeing regular Main Street businesses getting things, notices in the snail mail saying, hey, unless you want a massive number of complaints to, say, the health inspector or, you know, people to trash your reputation on Yelp or, you know, unless you want the cops showing up, you know, responding to bomb threats at your business, you know, all these disruptive things, you will pay us, you know, one or two bitcoins or I don't know what it is, you know, the equivalent of like $1,000. So these are sort of like shakedowns have been going on forever, right? You know, the mob has sort of done this forever, you know, the protection money. But now it's kind of, you know, these cyber criminals are finding new ways to extort people that kind of blur the lines between cybercrime and, you know, real world fraud.
Well, Brian Krebs, thank you so much for talking with us and stay safe and secure.
Hey, thanks. Pleasure's all mine.
Brian Krebs writes the blog Krebs on Security. His book, Spam Nation, about organized cybercrime, is scheduled for publication in November. You'll find a longer version of my interview with Krebs online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brugger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.